You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi everybody, this is the Cricket Badger podcast.
Each badger marks the track with its own scent.
His black legs are short but very powerful for digging. The name badger probably comes from the French word bêcher, meaning digger.
Hello everybody, welcome along to this edition of the Cricket Badger podcast. I'm James the Cricket Badger, as always taking you through the podcast today. Thank you to tvsportsblog.com for their support of the Cricket Badger podcast. It's much appreciated. Have a look on their website, some great sporting content on there, and give them a follow please at tvsportsblog on Twitter. Plenty of really good Cricket Badger podcasts coming up just around the corner. And today I'm joined by Colin Babb, the author who has a new book out, 1973 and Me, the England v West Indies Test Series and a Memorable Childhood Year. In 1973, Colin was just a young nipper living in London, bright-eyed, looking at the world, and he was woken up to cricket by the fact that the West Indies came over to this country. Colin hails from the Caribbean, his roots in Guyana, Guadeloupe and Barbados. Book covers not just the cricket, and it was a very important series that for the West Indies, but it also covers Colin's recollections and his social commentary on what was going on around London, around the UK, how important that West Indies tour was to the Caribbean community in this country. As you know, a lot of people from the Caribbean came across for work in the 50s, 60s, settled in England, obviously still had massive connections with the Caribbean. And when the West Indies cricket team came over in 1973, and obviously on other tours, there was a lot of pride that was placed in that team. And in 1973, they came up trumps, and obviously the rest is history. The next couple of decades from then on, pretty much the West Indies ruled the roost in terms of world cricket. For his book, 1973 and Me, Collins also talked to a number of the key members of the West Indies side, and it also looks at the history, identity, music and politics, shared family experiences of television in the 70s, memorable events, and of course, the cricket in 1973. Really good guest on this edition of the Cricket Badger podcast. I'm sure you'll enjoy it, so stay tuned. Early on, just to give you a little bit of an explanation for one of the early passages on this, because I don't introduce Colin until a little bit further into this edition of the podcast. We do it across WhatsApp, and on my WhatsApp, there's a picture of myself and Gordon Greenidge from a trip I had to the Caribbean once, and Colin does mention, he says, who's that in the picture with you? And that's what he's referring to. 1973 and Me, the England v West Indies Test Series, A Memorable Childhood Year by Colin Babb, who is my guest on this edition of the Cricket Badger podcast.
It's that Badger style.
I've never heard the surname Babb before, other than Phil Babb that used to play for Liverpool. Don't guess you're not related to him, are you?
Well, we're not related, but interestingly, Babb is a very popular name in Guyana and Barbados. And I understand through a woman I worked with years ago who knew his mother, who was Irish, that's why he played for Ireland, that his father was from Guyana. And that would make a lot of sense because Babb is a very Guyanese or Barbadian name, which is where my family come from. I've never met him, but I've met someone who knows his brother. That's as close as it goes. But yeah, I've been to Ireland a few times for work and for pleasure. And Phil was, I think, just finishing his career when I was in Ireland the last time. And I thought I'd go into a pub and sort of impress the locals and say, oh, well, you know, you might have heard of Phil Babb.
Yeah.
And then he said, oh, yeah, Phil Babb, he's shite.
There's no Irish in you then?
Well, interestingly, you should say this, actually. My father's family has a hint of, well, he claims his grandfather was Irish, but digging into it, I think he probably might have been English.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing is that a lot of Caribbean families have white ancestry because a lot of the men, principally, who went out to the Caribbean went without women.
Yes.
So, and obviously the whole thing with ownership of slaves and having their way with slave women. And also some of these relationships were consensual between black women and slave masters. And also after slavery had ended, there were lots of different types of relationships, some illicit, some between people who wanted to spend time with each other legitimately. So yeah, the Caribbean is a very diverse place, and that's why 1973 is such an important book.
I've been out to Barbados a few times, actually, cricket-related trips and what have you. And the last time we went out, we got treated very nicely by the Barbados Tourism Authority, who took us all over the place. And one of the trips that I went on was to one of the plantations and looking at the history of slavery, effectively, out in Barbados. It was very interesting.
Mm. Sugar, sugar, sugar. Once Europeans discovered they could make money producing sugar to please the sweet tooth of Europeans who discovered tea and coffee, it was just that's what these islands were for, really. A lot of sugar isn't really the engine that ticks the economy in these countries anymore. I mean, other things like tourism and, you know, bauxite and all God knows whatever else. So, yeah, it's not so much the same. Who's the picture? I can see a picture of you with somebody. I can't work out who it is.
Yeah, that was taken out in Barbados. That was with Gordon Greenidge.
Oh, really? God, he looks really different. Looks really different in that picture. Interestingly, my cousin in Barbados is an architect, and she was supposedly working on a school, which there's a school in Barbados which is named after him.
Yeah, okay.
Primary school, I believe. I didn't even know this. And apparently she was supposed to be working on the reconstruction of it, but I don't know what happened to that project.
Okay, well, he didn't mention that to me, but we had a very nice time, actually. I was out there covering the MCC games and various things with the Champion County Essex at the time. And I'd already interviewed Gordon a little bit earlier in the trip, but then we got all invited to his house because he does when there's tours and things over there, he's got a big backyard. Some of it's under corrugated iron, kind of like sheltered in the shade, a bit's open. But he does, sets up some catering. Everybody sits around and then they had a local musician came in and played for us. And yeah, it was very good.
That's fantastic. I've only met him once. That was at an event in Bristol to raise funds for the care of Winston Davis.
Okay, yes.
Who played for the West Indies, yeah. He lives in Worcestershire now, I think, or out that way somewhere. And there was an event every year to raise funds for his care. And there was a charity match and Gordon was playing. So I managed to have a meal with him, have a chat with him. And he didn't open up to me that much. He seemed quite reserved and quiet. But we had a little chat. I was trying to interview him for a book I was writing, and he wasn't giving much away, so I kind of gave up, basically.
He was quite quiet when I met him, really. He was just a very normal, kind of humble kind of guy, really. It was quite pleasant. It was quite nice for that to be the case sometimes, rather than being quite open and brash and ego-driven. He just seemed to be very, very normal.
Yeah, his story features in 1973 and me, because... are you recording all this, by the way?
I've recorded everything so far, but I haven't actually introduced you yet. It's a pleasure on the Cricket Badger podcast this edition to welcome Colin Babb, the author, 1973 and Me is his book. We're going to get all the way through that and what that means to him. It's basically, Colin, correct me if I'm wrong with this, it's your little bit of your life story. It's the West Indies over in England in 1973 and that tour, which I don't think has been chronicled too many times in book form. And it's also a little bit of the social, kind of racial heritage kind of stuff around the edges of that, about how the West Indies came over in 1973 and obviously from there on, they won 2-0 in 1973. They came back in 1976 and won again and went on a procession of victories from there on.
Yeah, that's right. 73 is a tour which I think has been ignored by a lot of people consumed by writing or speculating or supporting West Indies cricket, particularly those people who look at the history of the connection between West Indies cricket and the Caribbean community in Britain from 1950 onwards in particular. And 73 was important to me because by the time we got to the third test in 1973, we had a colour television, which meant that I could see the ball was red and the grass was green, which was quite sensational. Obviously, if you're a younger person tuning into this, you might find that about a bit strange, but it was quite a big thing. So that tour was very important for me for that reason. And also, it was the first cricket tour that I remember really feeling a sense of commitment to West Indies cricket. Although I would say leading up to the tour, I was getting more into cricket because football was my first love. It was that tour, it was a tour that really ignited my passion in the game. Although there was a build up to that. If you wanted to, you could watch John Player League cricket every Sunday on BBC Two. And that was a 40-over Sunday tournament sponsored by the John Player Cigarette Company, which of course seems very old fashioned now that cigarette companies can support and promote cricket tournaments. But yeah, so that it was that watching the Sunday League and that tour which ignited my passion. My background is in fact my mother's from Guyana and my father's from Barbados. So I'm part Guyanese, part Barbadian, but I've always felt more connected with Guyana because most of my family who were in Britain in the 60s and 70s were from Guyana. So I always felt much more Guyanese. And I was brought up also by two very strong characters who were Guyanese, my mother and my great-grandmother. But also that tour was important from a West Indian perspective because it was the early 70s. Many West Indian people were still finding their feet in Britain. There was the constant frustration and obstacle of racism and prejudice in housing, employment, education, and many other facets of life. Although some West Indian families had put a firm foothold in Britain, there were a lot of challenges which they still face today, the community in some ways, but in a different way. And when the West Indian team came over, they had almost mystical status in some eyes. And also, whether you were a cricket fan or not, if you were West Indian, you knew the tour was happening because people would be watching it on television or trying to get into a ground to watch the team play. So, yeah, the tours are very, very important, especially in the 60s and 70s. It's a period, I think, which has been slightly ignored when we're looking at that connection between West Indian cricket and the Caribbean community in Britain because there's often a heavy focus on, for example, the 76 Grovel Tour or the 84 Blackwash Tour. And I think we need to really examine 66 before 69 and 73 and obviously 1950 as tours which helped to cement that relationship and give the community here, the West Indian community, a chance to make that connection back home through cricket.
Cricket Badger Podcast is brought to you in association with tvsportsblog.com. Excellent sporting content. It's well worth a look and give them a follow on Twitter at tvsportsblog. How old were you in 1973? From what you're saying there, you were quite a young man and this was really your awakening and obviously the colour TV is a big part of that, but this is your first kind of conscious kind of watching of cricket.
Yeah, definitely. I was 9 going on 10, so I think your listeners can work out how old I am now. I'll move on very quickly, just in case they didn't get that and didn't want to rewind. So basically, yeah, I was 9 going on 10. I was living in South London. I was living with my Guyanese mother, my Guyanese great-grandmother, and my Barbadian father, who wasn't always around because he was in the army. So he's often posted overseas. And we lived in a street with people from various backgrounds. It was, I would say, a very regular street with working class and lower middle class families, a mixture of council house dwellers, housing association dwellers, and owner occupiers. And we didn't always see eye to eye with various people we shared the street with, but there again, there were other people in the street who we liked. So it was a fairly typical semi-urban experience living in Britain at that time. Obviously, there was a spectre of racism all around. I had one or two instances which I talk about in the book from around that time. But I guess that's why cricket was so important to West Indian people, because it gave us an outlet. It gave us something to focus on. It gave us a sense of pride. And also, you must remember that people came to this country from different parts of the Caribbean. They came from St. Lucia, Antigua, Jamaica, Barbados, Guyana, Trinidad, Dominica. So when they came to England or came to the UK, it was a chance to meet people from different parts of the Caribbean who you probably had not met before. And cricket added an extra unifying glue, which glued us all together for the 5 days of a test match. So it didn't matter whether you were Jamaican or Trinidadian, you had one focus.
Interesting you say that, Con, because all the stuff I see from the people actually living in the Caribbean, there's a big rivalry, isn't there, between the islands. But you're saying that in London at that time, there might have been that rivalry out of cricket, but when cricket came along, that was the glue that united you all.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't just say London. I would say the whole country, because one of the things I stress in this book and in other discussions I've had or interviews or things I've written is that the Caribbean community in Britain is not just a London community. I think we focus too much on that, and I think sometimes we focus on too much on the fact that it's mainly Jamaican and mainly in London. You know, our community is spread throughout the whole country. You could be in Bradford and meet a lot of people from Dominica. In Leeds, you'll meet a lot of people from St. Kitts and Nevis. In Reading, Reading has a history of a strong Barbadian community, for example. Luton and High Wycombe has a tradition of having people live there, reside there from St. Vincent. So it wasn't just a London experience. It was an experience which was nationwide. And I think although West Indian people in Britain shared similar migration issues, difficulties with racism and prejudice, subtly or more violent, there were still inter-island rivalries as well as ethnic rivalries amongst the community in Britain, which perhaps still exist. So if you are, say, for example, an Indo-Caribbean from Trinidad, you know, you may have some issues with, say, African Guyanese, for example, or, you know, or an Antiguan might not see eye to eye with someone from St. Vincent. You know, just like any part of the world, any region, you know, there were differences, similarities and differences. But from my observations growing up in the 70s and in the 80s, even though West Indians in Britain might have had disputes about the makeup of the team in terms of there's too many Barbadians in the team, or there are too many Jamaicans in the team, or we should have a Guyanese captain or a Trinidadian captain, and why haven't we got enough Antiguan players? Generally, I think we came together and supported the team as a whole. So it didn't matter who was scoring the runs or taking the wickets.
I find it quite interesting. One of my best mates from school is of Indian heritage. He was born in Harrogate. But I can remember as a kid saying to him when England were playing India, who are you supporting? Why are you supporting India? Because you were born in this country. And I remember him clear as a day, he turned to me and said, yeah, but I still have Indian heritage. I'm still very proud of kind of where I've come from. Is that something that you can relate to there? That, you know, although you're born in England, and those Caribbean roots run very deep, don't they?
Yeah, I think, I suppose, I'm not saying I was fortunate, but, you know, from a reasonably young age, I went to the Caribbean. So I went there for myself, or with my family, I should say. So I was able to have feet in both camps. I was able to live in Britain, but sometimes go to the Caribbean to touch the soil, as they say, meet my family and do other things.
And get some sunshine.
So I was completely aware. Yeah, you could say, yeah. So I was completely aware of that connection. And I grew up eating Guyanese food, whether it was curry and roti or garlic pork at Christmas. You know, for me, I lived in a very West Indian household. When I was outside of that household, I know Lenny Henry talks about this as well, I became slightly different. I had different friends from different backgrounds who I mixed with and liked or didn't like.
You've listened to the Louis Theroux podcast with Lenny Henry as well, haven't you? I listened to that and I found it fascinating.
I read his autobiography and he talked about that. And I think having a twofold existence is something which some people from different backgrounds have. I know one or two people I work with or I've been friends with who've had Irish parents who said similar things. So I don't think it's necessarily a West Indian thing. But for me, There was no decision or thinking about it. I supported the West Indies mainly because I was supporting teams that my family and friends of my family often talked about, all these players that I never actually saw myself. I mean, Hall and Griffiths, I didn't see. Ramadan and Valentine, I didn't see. The three W's, I didn't see. But these are figures that were spoken of in my house or my flat in their reverential terms. You know, they're almost like godlike figures. So growing up, I was always aware of these players. And obviously, when I came of age to watch cricket in the early 70s, I began to watch Lloyd, Kalacharan, Keith Boyce, Bernard Julian, Barry Sobers coming to the end of his career, Rohan Kanai. And these are my heroes. But also, talking about the twofold existence, I tended to support the UK entry in the Eurovision Song Contest, for example. So there you are. And also, I always supported British athletes, British boxers. And also, although I wasn't that keen on the England team growing up, I never felt as if supporting England was something that we were felt comfortable in doing if we were black in the 70s. But as I got older, I got really into supporting England, and I support England at football 100%. I think the World Cup in 98, when Glenn Hoddle was the manager, was when I really got behind England. And I think from then onwards, I became an England football fan and a West Indian cricket fan. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, a lot of people have twofold identities. And I think what you'll see is certainly within the heart and souls of people born here in the last 10, 15 years who may have a West Indian parent or a West Indian grandparent, who's to say that they're not going to support England at cricket if England played the West Indies? That's up to them. I personally don't really care whether you support England or the team of your ancestral or parental heritage. That's just up to you. I mean, I don't have any problem whatsoever with that. And I know one or two people who I don't know that well, but who were acquaintances of mine, who wanted to support England at cricket against the West Indies, and they were West Indians born and brought up here, and they weren't, let's say that wasn't such a popular choice. So the pressure comes from different angles, you know, to support one team or the other. That pressure can come from your own community, or it can come from the Tebbit test. But there again, I think it's just up to you to make your own choice, what you feel comfortable in doing. And for me, it was just an automatic choice to support the West Indies cricket team in the 70s, and the 73 test confirmed everything for me. I was able to watch them on TV and remember that very, very well, that series.
Fed up of collecting your team's matchday subs? Worried about carrying cash post-COVID-19? Try slateapp.co.uk. Less contact than contactless. Slate, the smartest way to collect weekly match fees and more. Download the app, slateapp.co.uk. Not just for cricket, any clubs that collect subs. It just makes sense. Stick it on the Slate. slateapp.co.uk.
My friend Santanu, who I referred to in that previous question, he supports India against England. He supports India, obviously, when India are playing anybody else. He supports England when they're playing everybody else but India. And his wife's Australian, so that adds an extra complication into the dynamic of that household. But
I'm just laughing because we have one or two dynamics in our household, because I'm Guyanese, Bajan background, brought up in England. My wife is Albanian. So my son, if he becomes a very good footballer, can play for Guyana, Barbados, England or Albania. He said that his top football team is England and his second football team is Albania. He says his top cricket team is England, his second is the West Indies. So there you go. so that's the way it goes. I mean, you know, you just make your own choices. But I mean, for me, the West Indies were everything. They were a symbol of pride. They were a way of getting won over the English. So if you felt you were being downtrodden upon in this country, beating the English at cricket was just a way of getting back at them. It was kind of a symbol of revenge. But for me, it wasn't just about England. I wanted the West Indies to beat everybody, whether it was India, Pakistan, Australia, New Zealand anybody. I just wanted the West Indies to conquer all, really.
What you talk about there, though, in the 1970s, about the feeling of being downtrodden, racism was, I mean, we're talking about racism in 2020, but in 1970s, it was overt. It was in the windows. No blacks, no dogs, no whatever, wasn't there? No Irish. You talk, I think, in the book about some of the TV programmes in those days, which Love Thy Neighbour and things like that, which, you know, any youngster watching that now would kind of fall off the sofa if they saw some of the things that were portrayed in those programmes. So it was a very different time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a different time. But to be honest with you, I don't look back at that time with horror and dread, because it wasn't all bad. A lot of my life around that time was fun and enjoyable. It wasn't grim. It wasn't about being persecuted all the time. So that's what I try and put in the book. There was shade and humour, seriousness, politics. It was all there, all going on. And I do refer to programmes that we watched, like Love Thy Neighbour, The Comedians, Eurovision Song Contest, Miss World. I mean, many people would balk at the idea of beauty contests being on terrestrial television, but we watched them. And to be honest with you, we weren't snaring at them. We enjoyed them. They're not popular now, but there again, you have a programme on Channel 4 called Naked Attraction, where people seem to pick their partners based on complete nakedness, and that seems to be quite vogue, you know. So, you know, what's vogue and what isn't, God only knows. But seriously, it wasn't all bad, it wasn't all good, and that's what I try and put in the book. But one thing for certain is that what the West Indies team did is that when they arrived, it was so important to our community. They were almost our ambassadors, and they represented us. And you know, if they beat England at cricket, especially in England, it just made us feel really, really, really good. And not just if they won, but if they played in a meticulous in a particular style, you know, not just a flamboyant style, but in a typical swagger and West Indian way with discipline as well. And that combination showed that, you know, as West Indians, united without worrying about which island we came from or what our ethnic makeup was, you know, we could come together and work together and achieve success, which is the sort of thing I got when I spoke to Derek Murray about his feelings about the team who came here in the 60s and the 70s. And of course, you know, having Guyanese heritage meant that when Rahan Kanai led the team here in 1973, for me, that was very important. It was very important for a number of reasons. It gave non-Caribbean people in this country and outside the UK a chance to get a slice of the diverse nature of Caribbean society, the fact that we have people in the Caribbean of African heritage, Indian heritage, mixed Indian and African heritage, European heritage, Amerindian heritage, Portuguese heritage, and some of the 1973 team were made up of those different ethnic and heritage backgrounds. So yeah, that was why, looking back, that team was so important. You had Inchan Ali and people like Alvin Kalacharan and Rahan Kanai, who were Indian Caribbean heritage. And then you had other players who were of African Caribbean heritage. And, you know, you had the opening batsman, Steve Camatch, who was of Portuguese Guyanese heritage, who unfortunately was injured in a pre-test match at Hampshire. He got injured. Interestingly, he got injured facing the bowling and of Andy Roberts, who was playing one of his first games for Hampshire as a young, fast bowler. And he went on to do one of the two things, didn't he? Yeah, it was all going on. It was all going on in terms of that representation and that link to the Caribbean and revealing a sense of the diverse nature of Caribbean society, whether or not people from those different social, economic and ethnic backgrounds always got on. Well, obviously they didn't. But, you know, it was good that that team was able to reveal that to a wider public, as did the 1950 team, which came here, and as some of your listeners know, the West Indies won their first Test series in England during the 1950 tour, and their first Test victory was at Lord's. So that very year, you know, cricket, lovely cricket, and that tour was important because many British observers of cricket, they were able to see an Indo-Caribbean cricketer, Sunny Ramadan, who took many wickets on that tour, as most people know, from Trinidad. So for them, it was the first time they could see somebody of Indian heritage representing the West Indies, another glimpse into the diverse nature of the Caribbean.
Colin, we've never met, but I know you're a good guy. And do you know why I know you're a good guy? Because you're a Leeds United fan, and so am I. And I know in the book, you look at Albert Johansson's role in the lead side. I think you also look at some of the other black players playing in the 1970s in England. How would you bring that into the discussion in terms of the significance of them and their role in Caribbean society in England?
Well, I didn't know you were a Leeds fan, so hey, that means I'm definitely going to keep talking. You've got me. You've got me for as long as you got me for as long as you want me. Yeah, I got into Leeds basically by watching TV. The first football match I remember watching was the 1970 FA Cup final against Chelsea. The replay, not the first match, but the replay. And when I left school and got a little older, I spent a bit of time across the country and out of the country. And I spent a bit of time in Leeds for one reason or the other. That was the reason I supported Leeds initially, because of that match. And it was just watching that team wearing white shirts. I remember the white shirts gripped me through my black and white TV. And I remember getting very upset when they lost the replay. And from then on, I became a Leeds fan. And I watched my first Leeds match about 5 years after that. But for me, the reason why football took up a bit of space in the book, and you're not the first person to ask me why, there was a chapter dedicated to football, Leeds United and Clyde Best, Albert Johansson and other players. It's because leading up to 73, football was my first love. I wasn't really interested in cricket as an intense way as I was leading up to 73 and afterwards. Football was certainly my first love, and I used to watch it all the time on television. In London, we had the big match on independent television, and obviously the BBC had Match of the Day and occasionally Sports Night with my favourite ever commentator, David Coleman. So yeah, football was my first love, and I had all the football cards that we used to swap in the playground with the very hard, tasteless chewing gum. Yeah, it was very important to me that I was able to see black footballers on television. And I remember seeing Clyde Best. He was probably one of the only black players at the time when I was growing up. And when I saw him play for West Ham, it was just, it's hard to explain now, of course, but he was just, it was sensational watching him. It was so inspirational. There was a black player on the pitch. Even my mum would watch it just to watch Clyde Best. It was that important. And I interviewed Clyde Best for the book. And he told me he was actually a decent cricketer when he was growing up in Bermuda. And he also told me that he remembered the 1973 series. So as soon as he said those two things, he had me hooked. But I won't reveal too much. You'll have to read the book for that. Albert Johansson, again, connecting football with cricket and the way things were at the time. I got into the life of Albert when he retired. I found out more about his life after he finished playing, because I didn't really remember watching him so much when he was playing for Leeds. I found out more about him later when I was growing up. And his story is absolutely fascinating. He married a Jamaican woman in Leeds, had a family here. He was the first black African to play in a FA Cup final. He talks about all the racist abuse he got living in Leeds, and also from Liverpool players in that 65 Cup final. He had a very, very hard time. But one thing that was tough to me was that the Leeds fans loved him. He was very, very appreciated, well appreciated by the supporters, and he was absolutely loved and appreciated. He was a real novelty factor, of course, but he was an amazing player. And can you imagine playing now on these wonderful pitches with protection from referees and VAR and the amazing salaries that footballers get? Albert would have been a superstar now.
Absolutely would. But the black players in the first division, as it was then, obviously the equivalent of the Premier League that we know these days, going forward a few years, aren't you, to the West Brom days when they had Cyril Regis and Brendan Batson. Who was the third member of the Three Degrees? Can't remember his name.
Laurie Cunningham.
Laurie Cunningham, of course. Yeah, probably the better of the three players, wasn't he?
But the reason I mentioned Cyril, just interject a little bit. The reason I mentioned Cyril in the book is because, again, he told me when I interviewed him that he was very keen on cricket when he was growing up. Interestingly, his father was from St. Lucia and his mother from French Guiana, but had roots in Guadeloupe, and some of my family from Guadeloupe as well. So I kind of felt that connection. So I think what I'm trying to say in the book is there were players playing around that time in the 70s who, you know, were beacons of hope for a lot of black supporters watching them play on television. They also had a link with cricket, for example. Yeah.
But just on that, Colin, I mean, I can totally get where you're coming from, that gives you a bit of kind of personal pride in who you are, because they're representing you effectively on that pitch, aren't they? I guess that's what you're saying, and that gives you,
to a point,
but
a sense of encouragement,
But as a young man watching that and seeing how they were treated in those times, I mean, people throwing bananas out the stands, the monkey chants, all the rest of the stuff that was going on in the 70s, you're getting that kind of sense of, I'm supporting that guy because he's a bit like me. But then you're seeing how he's treated. How does that affect a young man?
Yeah, I write about that. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but in the book I talk about the first time I remember really hearing that on TV. Players being booed for the colour of their skin. It was West Brom playing at Manchester United in, I think, 78, 79. And they went to Old Trafford and won 5-3. I think Cyril Regis got a couple. I think Cantona got one. And I remember Larry Cunningham playing brilliantly. It's funny, I remember that the first time round. And I remember Gerald Finstad, the first ever football commentator, I remember calling out football fans for booing the black players. And I remember watching the highlights and hearing that. And I was actually stunned. Not so much that the players are being booed, because sometimes when you watch these matches on TV, you could just about hear the boos coming through the TV. But that somebody had called the supporters out on television. And that's why Gerald Finstad, to me, was an absolute legend, you know, for doing that. Even though the football grounds were difficult places to go, I personally didn't really get any personal abuse directed at me. Maybe one or two of the players, but I think it was worse in the 80s and the 70s, to be honest, because I think in the 80s, the hard right politics came into it and made it a bit more vicious. But certainly when I was watching football in the 70s and going to matches occasionally, I didn't really hear anything. It wasn't that bad. I think it got worse in the 80s when it got mixed up with hardline far right politics and it got a bit nasty. People will sell newspapers outside grounds and things like that. But certainly, a lot of the players had to put up with a lot during those years. And that's why I kind of, not hero worship them, but admire them. You know, Cyril Regis and Clyde Best and Addie Coker and Batson. And a bit later, a player called Terry Connor, who played for Leeds, who for me was an absolute hero. But he seems to have been forgotten. Watching him in the 80s playing for Leeds as Keith Gordon's debut, didn't he? That was quite amazing. But, you know, it wasn't just about the black players. There were a lot of players I admired who didn't have Caribbean heritage. People like Billy Bremner, like Frank Worthington, Stan Bowles. I suppose the Mavericks, you might say, Alan Hudson, Rodney Marsh, Tony Curry. You know, it wasn't just about watching football and just picking out the Caribbean players or the players of Caribbean and African heritage. I know a lot of other players I admired, and I mentioned that in the book as well.
When the West Indies arrived in 1973, they'd not won a test series in 5 years. They'd lost 2-0 to England the previous tour in 1969. Was there much expectation from West Indian cricket fans that they were going to do something special?
From the research I've done and from the people I've spoke to, Derek Murray, Keith Fletcher, various journalists, Clayton Goodwin, it seemed to be a bit of a mixed bag, really. England were probably just about the favourites because they were playing at home and the West Indies had not won a series for a while. So I suppose before the test, most people would have judged, unless you were a really enthusiastic, blind to any other kind of reality West Indian fan, so England would have been probably the slight favourites. But Derek Murray in the book, I won't quote him word for word because you'll have to buy the book to find out. I think he was saying to me that it was almost as if the West Indian team was just about to come together. They knew they could do it, but they just needed to prove they could do it. And I think this tour was probably the time when they felt this is where we have to deliver. We know we can deliver, and we have to deliver. And we're beginning to get our act together. Obviously, I suppose whether you follow cricket or not, you might be aware that the West Indies won the series. So therefore, what I'm trying to say in this book is that the reason why this tour has or deserves more attention is that it probably was one of the foundations on which the West Indies built a better future from 1975, 6 and beyond. But also it was, for me, memorable for the pitch invasions. I remember when I started to go to cricket, a bit after 73,
it was just common to run on the pitch. So, you know, someone scored a four or hit a six into the crowd, but mainly a four. All these young schoolboys, including me, of course, would just run onto the pitch and try and field the ball. And at the end, you'd run onto the pitch and try and get under the pavilion to chant at the players, you know. I don't know whether you did that when you went to cricket, but it was just such a common thing. And if you watch the 73 series, it just reveals that there were so many West Indians and English supporters who were just full of joy and happiness and watching the series and running on the pitch and really having a great time. Obviously, now with the security situation and the way things are in most public arenas, you can't really do that. And I kind of understand that. And stewarding has become quite a serious occupation as well. But certainly it was joy unleashed for many, many supporters, and particularly West Indian supporters when they could see a team coming from the Caribbean, beating the English, playing great cricket, and being able to watch it and to celebrate that. And I think some of the players appreciated that. Maurice Foster, again, who is a West Indian player who deserves more attention, I think. He was on that tour as well. And he played in the third test at Lord's. And he was saying that it was amazing for a lot of the players to get that feeling of being out of the Caribbean, playing to such a loud and raucous and enthusiastic fan base, whether they're at the Oval, Lord's, Old Trafford, or wherever that West Indies played.
I found it quite interesting as well. It wasn't the only Caribbean tour of that year, because Bob Marley and the Wailers came over and undertook their first UK tour in the same year as well. So I would have loved to have seen that. I mean, I'd have only been 4 years old, but I'd have loved to have seen that because fantastic band that he had. But that, I mean, that would have been something special, I guess, for the Caribbean community too.
Yeah, and the non-Caribbean community, because a lot of people who appreciated his music were not all West Indian.
Yeah.
What I try to do in the book is talk about not just cricket, although cricket is the scene that runs through the book, but talk about other things that happened that year which directly or indirectly connected with me or my family or Caribbean or non-Caribbean people that I knew or didn't know. And that included that tour in 73 by Bob Marley, also the Eurovision Song Contest of that year, CARICOM being formed, which is, I suppose, the Caribbean version of the European Union. Britain joined the common market in 1973. So I talk about that and how that connects with Brexit. Whether you voted for Brexit or not, to me that's immaterial. It still was an important year. And also I talk about how my identity has shifted a bit since 1973. Where cricket is connected with that or not, you'll have to read the book and find out.
Just going back to the cricket then, to finish off with, Colin, as you said, the West Indies won that series 2-0. They won the first test match and the third test match through the middle test. Ron Headley also made his debut, and the kind of meat in the sandwich between George and Dean, isn't it? I mean, I did a book called Following On in the Footsteps of Cricketing Fathers and spoke to Dean about the pressure of following on with that surname. And Ron was a very good Worcestershire player. Got a little bit lucky because of the injury that you mentioned earlier on in the podcast, but Ron came in and played his only two test matches in that summer.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that you might notice in the book is that I talk about players who seem to have been ignored when we talk about West Indian cricket and its connection with the community in Britain. And one of the players who really deserves a lot more than he gets in terms of attention is Ron Headley, who's a fabulous player for Worcestershire. Mm. And he helped them to win championships. And at one point, just like Gordon Greenidge, he was able to play for England because he came here as a teenager and lived here for quite a few years. So he was actually qualified to play for England, just like Gordon Greenidge was. And in fact, Gordon Greenidge and Ron Headley apparently were both in the mix to replace Steve Kamash to become the new opener with Roy Fredericks. But eventually, Ron Headley got the nod. Looking back, I mean, I didn't really know of that until I did some more research and spoke to some more people. I'm so pleased that Ron got his opportunity in his 30s to represent the West Indies. And if you read the book, you'll find out what he thinks about that and what other people think about the fact that it did take him that long to get his opportunity. And he talks about his first morning playing test cricket, opening the batting, at the Oval on the first day of the test, he tells a tale about how he coped with that. And again, you can read that. And also, I interviewed Frank Hayes, who was one of my favourite non-Caribbean players. And he talks about his experiences during that series. And yes, he made a pretty good start to his test series. Some of you may know, some may not, but you can find out again by reading 1973. And well, me?
I don't think it's a big secret, Colin, that he made a century in that series. So that's I don't think that's a massive spoiler for your book that Frank Hayes scored 100.
Oh God! I don't know. Maybe I'm overcooking the spoiler alert thing there. But yeah, I'm actually doing that for added comedy value, I must say. But Frank Hayes scored 100 on debut. And again, I guess the 70s Lancashire team were very attractive to me with their one-day successes. Yeah. The fans singing, "Oh, lanky, lanky, lanky Lancashire," which obviously, if you're from Yorkshire, you might not really want to appreciate.
Yorkshire.
There you go. But I was really inspired in a way by watching Frank Hayes, his blonde hair, youthful exuberance, you know, so that comes across in the book. And also, for any Yorkshire listeners, I spent a bit of time talking to the Leeds Caribbean Cricket Club as well. Okay. Who've been in existence for a pretty long time. So, yeah, they get a bit of a nod in the book as well. But I think one of the things I want to mention is that a lot of people stepped up and spoke to me for the book, and I really appreciate the time that they gave me to listen to my questions, share their stories, share their experiences and memories. Some people said things which I didn't put in the book for fear of libel. I'm only joking, but in a way, there were some quite revealing things said to me which I felt I couldn't put in. So yeah, a big thank you to other players I haven't mentioned or other people I've not mentioned. That's Dennis Amos and Dickie Bird, Lance Gibbs, who else I speak to? Bernard Julian. I didn't speak to him directly, but Reza Abazali, a friend of mine and journalist in Trinidad, spoke to him for the book. Alvin Kalacharan said some wonderful things. And Simon Lister, the author of Fire in Babylon, kindly wrote the foreword to this book as well.
The 1973 series, obviously a success for the West Indies. We all know what happens when Tony Greig said that he was going to make the West Indies grovel in 1976, because it was far from that. It was the start of a glorious period in West Indies cricket history, wasn't it? They all dominant. Obviously, there was a little bit of a changing in the guard, the personnel that came back in 76. You had Viv Richards, Michael Holding, and a few of the other new names coming into that side. But from that 1973 series, the flag was put in the ground, wasn't it? And from there on, West Indies really did catapult themselves into the best team in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say by talking about this book and talking about this series, is that it was important to me personally, but it was important for the future of West Indies cricket, and especially teams that came to England on tour from then on. The West Indies were very, very dominant in England, and I think 73 was a very, very big turning point. But also, it talks about the book itself. I mean, moving away from the cricket, the book talks a lot about the history of Caribbean migration to Britain, and there are other perspectives on history, identity, music, and politics. So what I'm trying to say is that you don't have to be a cricket fan or have Caribbean heritage or have grown up in the 70s to get something out of this book.
Colin Babb, it's been great to have you on the podcast. 1973 and Me, the England and West Indies Test Series and a Memorable Childhood Year, published by Hanseep Publications Limited. Where can people get it from, Colin?
Because of the ongoing situation, there has been a delay in getting the book into shops and online retailers, etc. So the best way to get your early bird copy in advance and during the West Indies tour of 2020 is to contact me on my website or through my website, which is colinbabauthor.com, colinbabauthor.com, or I'm on Twitter at GaveTheCrowd, GaveTheCrowd, or on Instagram, colinbabauthor. So yeah, colinbabauthor.com is probably the best way to get through. Just find me. And I'll arrange to get a book to you ASAP with the necessary payment details.
Colin, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Good luck with your book, and thanks for talking to me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much. It's that Badger style.
My thanks to Colin for joining me on this edition of the Cricket Badger podcast, a fellow Leeds United fan. So fingers crossed over the next few weeks that Leeds finish off the job and playing Premier League football, but that is just a personal opinion. I'm sure there's plenty of you out there shouting at the Cricket Badger podcast at the moment saying, yeah, Leeds United, dirty Leeds, etc. Well, be quiet because it's my podcast. I can say what I like, but I hope you enjoyed that. And if you want to buy that book, 1973 and Me, The England, The West Indies Test Series and A Memorable Childhood Year by Colin Babb, forward by Simon Lister, published by Hansey Publications. Colin was giving you the information at the end there. If you missed his website address and you want to know more details on how you can get your hands on this book, www.colinbabb.com. Thank you for joining me on this edition of the Cricket Badger podcast, and thank you for listening over the last few weeks of lockdown and before that as well. The Cricket Badger podcast is going from strength to strength, and that is down to your ears and your listens and your time of hopefully enjoying the Cricket Badger podcast that we've been putting out there. So stay tuned, plenty more to come, as I say, and if you could just spare me a little bit of time, it'd be much appreciated. Add a bit of a like, a subscribe, or a nice comment on whatever podcast platform you listen to the Cricket Badger podcast on, and that'll do it no harm at all. Thanks again to tvsportsblog.com for their support of the Cricket Badger podcast. That has been invaluable over the last few weeks of COVID-19 and everything else that we've been going through. Give them a follow on Twitter at TV Sports Blog. Give the podcast a follow on Twitter as well, at @cricket_badger. There's all the plugs out the way. If you do all that, you'll keep in the loop and you'll know when the next editions of the Cricket Badger podcast are coming out into your ears. And stay tuned, because there's plenty more to come. I've been James. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and I'll see you next time when I bring you the next edition of the Cricket Badger podcast.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.